Our lives are shaped by many things. For a 9-year-old boy in Fargo, North Dakota, it was a morning paper route. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I'm Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. My co-host, Stephen DeLuque, and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. My guest today is Michael J. Strand, who is an associate professor and head of the Visual Arts Department at North Dakota State University. His artistic medium is clay, but his artistic process is much broader than that. This will be a two-part program, and most of this afternoon we will spend getting to know a bit about Michael's background and his general philosophy about life. Next week, he will fill us in on some of the projects that he holds near and dear. An artist, a sociologist, a philosopher. He knows that objects have been directly connected to social movements throughout human history. Think prayer shawls, peace pipes, ceremonial bowls. The list could go on for quite a while. I met up with Michael this past May when I was attending a national metalsmithing conference in Boston. True, he is not a silversmith, but his presentation to a very captivated audience certainly sent many away doing a lot of thinking. I encourage you to go to his website, Michael J. Strand. You'll be able to get a much broader idea of what he does. Here now is Michael. I am here with Michael Strand. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you? It's great to be here.
I'm just fine. You gave a presentation at this Society for North American Goldsmiths conference.
2 days ago.
2 days ago. Yeah. I was very glad that I was out of bed and there because it was captivating, and I thought, this is somebody people need to know more about, so I'm delighted that you were willing to join us.
I like to talk. I like to have conversations, so this is great. Yeah, this is wonderful. Yeah.
You mm-hmm. were born and still live in Fargo, North Dakota, am I correct?
Yeah, I was born in Morehead, Minnesota, which is right across the river from Fargo. I'm a proud Minnesotan who now lives in North Dakota. But actually, I haven't lived there my whole life. It's one of those things where you romantically come home after 20 years away. But yeah, now I'm back in my home area of Fargo-Moorhead, a border city. So Fargo being on the North Dakota side, Moorhead on the Minnesota side.
I'll speak for myself. Certainly Fargo only became really conscious sort of name because of the movie. I imagine you get that. Quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, I travel a lot, so I do a lot of international projects and work, and when people ask where I'm from, I typically say Fargo, North Dakota, and people often reference the movie and they ask, you know, is it like that all the time? Here's what I like to say. I mean, Fargo is an amazing place. It's a bit like the movie. It's a bit like high-tech industry. It's a bit like hipster. It's kind of like Madison plus Portland plus slightly conservative part of the country. It's a very interesting mix, and there's a lot going on, actually. Yeah.
And you are a professor?
Yeah, I'm a professor at North Dakota State University, and I'm also the head of visual arts. It's a Research One land grant institution. It's one of the flagship universities for the state, which has a great university system. There's two, you know, state with a modest population.
Talk a little bit more about what the research term is doing in reference to research versus teaching versus how your job plays out during a week, a day, a month?
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's interesting because the expectation of research on faculty members is literally, for me, it's 30%. You know, sometimes it's 40. I'm an administrator. So 30% of my job essentially is to be very active in the field. And I take that really seriously, but I think there's ways to organize your week where it becomes part of what you do. So the research part, creative activity is the other word they use. Like, you know, an activity is like golfing or playing chess or something. But so creative work, research, it's embedded in the school. So my studio is at the university. And I involve my students with projects. The teaching part, I teach one class a semester. And the great part about that is I can be all in. That one class becomes the focus of my effort for teaching.
And what are you teaching?
A variety of things from a course that I teach called Engage You on. That's an engagement class that's cross-disciplinary. And recently I've been teaching Introduction to Ceramics, which I just love teaching at this stage in people's lives, especially because I get a lot of non-art majors, where what you present to them is, in essence, completely new. Especially, you know, you're a pre-dental student, and all of a sudden, by the end of the semester, you're an art minor, which is wonderful, which makes sense for a pre-dental student to be a ceramic emphasis minor.
In my 31 years at a state university in California, even though things changed toward the end, it was easily 80% non-majors.
Uh-huh.
And I felt that it was a very rewarding place to be, to watch eyes open up and to have people get excited.
When I went to college, I was a psychology major. I was 3.5 years into my degree when I took a class in ceramics to fulfill an elective. And it ended up being a 7-year undergrad because of it. And so this whole thing around efficiency that you must be done, I get it. But that's too bad because, you know, they expect 18-year-olds to know exactly what they're going to do for the rest of their life. It's ridiculous. Our educational system has transformed into something that's like job training. And it's not even about, oh, this student is in this area, maybe they'll become an art major. It's that in some way, what you can do is connect them to possibly a lifetime of really being connected to the arts. That's what we need. We need people who care about the arts. If that's where it happens. That's the great thing about working with non-art majors is that.
At the school, how many different disciplines are there?
It's a very traditional program. We have an amazing facility. It's probably the best art facility within, 200 miles in right downtown Fargo, which is interesting. The campus is about 2 miles away, and we are right in the urban center along with a couple other departments.
I have to admit a definite level of envy as I saw the photograph of your studio at the school. And
right.
I went, okay, I know there are places that do this, but mine did not.
We all have studios like this, so studio is permeable. And being a social cat, I like the idea of students coming and ask questions. Because of that, it's maybe not as fast as it could be, but that's all right. I mean, I am there. Modeling a way that I approach work, and that becomes maybe not the way, but they can see what's happening on a weekly basis.
Do you remember what it was about clay that grabbed you, or was it just more about creating?
In high school, I had this really great art teacher, Mrs. Thurn, and I wasn't a very good art student. I mean, I was a football player, but I was also, in my heart, a non-Western thinker. I knew that. The way that I interacted with other men specifically, and the locker room thing. I grew up in a really strongly feminist household and a fairly poor household growing up. So I didn't have the kind of exposure to art, but I had a really good art teacher. I remember there was a time when I was drawing a football player, of course, because that's what you would draw. And Mrs. Thurn said, "Michael, I really love how you try. You're doing well, but I don't see this as being your future." And she was such a great human being. Because I was like, I think I want to do art. And she's like, maybe you could do some other things. Anyways, when I took that ceramic class in college, the first time I got a really bad grade. And I was a good student, but I just didn't, I had a lot of fun in college. And I got married shortly after that. My wife said, "How can you get a C in ceramics? It seemed like you'd like that. Why don't you take that again?" So I took it again, and it was with a graduate student who just completely engaged me in the idea that making is a different way of thinking. And what it did is it always knew, one, I was a non-Western thinker, right? I just wasn't working through ideas the same way that people typically do. And I knew there was a different kind of intelligence that I had, one being social. I was a very connected human being with other people. But the other part is just this, that there's something in our hands, right? In the moment that I understood that and connected to it, while I wasn't very talented at all in the beginning, the idea that seeing 50 bowls on a rack and end of a 3-hour making session and like stepping back and taking off your apron and seeing like a tangible reflection of growth and learning, like I could see it, right? I could see where I was making decisions and I was using an intelligence I'd never really used before. It wasn't about making something perfect like a drawing. It was the three-dimensional manifestation. It was real. It wasn't an illusion of anything. And I really connected to that. And while I was a pacifist football player, and I didn't play football in college, but that competitiveness was still there, like, and I still have that. Like, I'm not competitive with other people, but internally. So making these objects and seeing those 50 bowls on that rack satisfied that need to see tangible result. And so it wasn't really extremely romantic in the idea of, oh, craft, or, oh, it was more like connecting with a way of thinking that made sense finally. And then what happens is once you get into a making cycle, I think that's the wonderful thing about people at any age getting involved with making. It satisfies something that is beyond just your brain and your guts. It's like in between. It's like your heart. There's something about making that that satisfies, I think, an innate need for us to create. So tapping into that, and then that competitive spirit, and then going, and then having an amazingly supportive spouse, partner. I came home from school and said, you know, I think I want to be a potter. And she's like, great. You know, that was a wacky turn, right? You know, that was the new direction. And then I remember that weekend we went out and bought art supplies. Like, I'm an art major now. I need art supplies. I need some drawing paper. So I, like, went headlong in love then at that point. And still not understanding anything about art, really. But I knew that I finally had a way of thinking and expressing and was motivated. I had decent grades in college. I'm good at unpacking concepts, but I just didn't care. I mean, I liked the psychology part, I liked the education part that I was had gone in and looked at, but at that moment, it was just sort of over. Like, I knew this was it. And then from the moment I said that, it has just been like game on. I'm going with this, like, all the way. That story, I think, in some ways is what's wrong with our educational system, in that in the current educational environment, I would take in a class and I said, well, I got to get my degree done. Every way, they don't want you to do what I did there. At between 17 and 21, there's this massive growth, and we expect students to know. It's just really, I think, counterproductive in that way.
So. I had the conversation with several students over the years, realized often I was perhaps the first. They were now taking some art classes. It wasn't what their major was. They were kind of feeling adrift.
Right.
And I'm going, you don't quite understand. This is the normal.
Yeah, right.
And the fact that you're questioning things may be uncomfortable,
right,
but it doesn't mean you're crazy.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Ears on Art here at KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Our guest today is Michael J. Strand, an associate professor of art and head of the visual arts at North Dakota State University in Fargo. Today, we're learning much about Michael's background and philosophy. Next week, he will talk about some of his community-based artistic projects. But now, we learn about how a paper route at age 9 changed his life.
You know, I want to step back, though, because I think formatively, there's another thing that's really important as far as being a maker, a craftsperson, an artist, whatever. But when I was 9 years old, I got a paper route. One of the reasons I got the paper route is because we didn't have a lot of money in our household, and frankly, some of that money would go to buy food, right? 9 years old, you're not supposed to have a paper route until you're 10, and I was a big guy, so didn't question when I put 10 years old on the little form. And I got a route for the Fargo Forum, a daily newspaper, and so every day I would do this route. And this is really important. I keep thinking how formative this was. Because if you think about what that is, it's having a route where you walk the same thing. Like, I remember perfecting the route. Like, you know, as a paper carrier, you if you do it every day, you start to nerd out on certain things. It'd be like, how many steps can I take? Like, I'd count the steps. I'd like do all the things you do as a craftsperson in the studio, but not knowing that repetition and that kind of like, how do I get the paper there? How do I throw it here? And that every day, that work ethic, number one. And now Fargo, you got to realize this is, you know, this is something that sounds like one of those things where you tell your kids that they walk both ways uphill, you know, in 30 below weather. But it was definitely the 30 below in the winter for 5 months. So having a paper out where you're responsible for it every day at the age of 9 and having that route until you're 17. I have had a job since I was 9 years old, and I'm 45, 46. So I've had a job for 37 years. I'm not saying that's actually a good thing. I'm not sure I'd want my kids to have a paper out right now. But it was a formative thing for me. Every day, some sort of consistent effort towards an end has a reward. The connection to the family part is, my mom was the real breadwinner in the house. My father was pretty disconnected and unique and interesting in his own way. But having a really amazing activist mother who ended up doing really great things in her life, and how she didn't really ask for support, but appreciated the fact that I could recognize that we needed it. That also was very formative. Now, I think I grew up a little bit quick. You know, I think that's why I had a lot of fun at the end of my high school days. I think that concept of working and repeating and going every day also was a foundation. It made sense when I could see those 50 cups. It was not that different than that consistent effort.
Seeing the papers land where they were supposed to, and yeah, knowing that you had an empty bag when you came home.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was, and hanging that thing up and, you know, getting oatmeal because I'm like at that point frozen. And so that was a really important thing. The other thing is that, you know, especially when we get into the content of what I do, having a mother who was an activist, a very quiet leader in a community who died at a very young age to cancer, and then from that humble kind of way that she approached her engagement with the community around early childhood activism and starting up daycare centers all over Fargo-Moorhead led to this park in her name, right? And so, and there is something really important here, because I came back to Fargo after she passed away, and like in some ways such a very difficult decision to do that, because knowing if my mother was still alive, we were very close. Coming home would have been the most, first of all, she was so proud of her son being quote-unquote a professor. Myself and my siblings were all first-generation college, within our family. My parents didn't go to college, didn't have the opportunity to. But coming home would have been so sweet. But coming home then became really like a mission in a way of how do I kind of live through what she did as a human being. So all of those things are so important. You know, they're part of our histories that form who we are, obviously.
Yeah. I find that I get closer to those things as I allow myself to acknowledge their total impact. And it was interesting, when I was in graduate school at Cranbrook, Richard Thomas, the head of the metalsmithing department, had started this little survey of his own to just ask the question, how did you get interested in da-da-da-da-da? What he learned was that there was just this real high correlation between his students, anyway, having a positive experience working with their hands, like ages 7 to 9, often in conjunction with their fathers. In that era, it would have been the fathers who would have been doing a lot of that. And I went, bingo. Because my father loved to create, and he died when I was 8, but I got it, and it carried on. He took me to a hobby store one day because he had brought home this very rudimentary sailboat kit, and I wanted to do another one, and we went to the store, and it was one of the only times that I saw him get really frustrated. Everything that was something that I might have been able to do most of was already in plastic. So we got a chunk of balsa wood, and then he showed me how I could shape that into a boat hull. And then when he died, I just kept doing those things. And a mother who claimed forever that she wasn't artistic, which was just hogwash, but because she couldn't paint.
Right.
The gold standard was out there, and that was that was it. I find it enriching and very fulfilling to be able to make those connections. And there are many times when I'm using my hands, the hand I see in front of me is my mother peeling an apple. That skill of not cutting your thumb off as you draw a knife toward it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can say, well, it wasn't about art, but it certainly was in the long run. It was about the making.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
You've mentioned the non-Western, Western kind of thinking.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit in terms of how you were sensing that you weren't quite fitting?
I've always, I don't know. Well, okay. So I'm, a 6'4", big frame, big guy. But I've always felt very, very connected, balanced, like masculine and feminine. that I didn't look at the world through the lens of testosterone. Mm-hmm. And I knew that because I was around a bunch of guys who did. And the conversations that would happen and how I would feel about those conversations within young men were very uncomfortable. And at that age, you go along with conversations. But I just knew, like, and that's just one example. Other examples would be like this. I have always had an intense sense of empathy for other people's mm-hmm. kind of feelings and other people's realities. Not that that's not Western, but it was different than my peers who would just assume, make fun of somebody who is having a problem, especially somebody you don't know. Also, the way that my brain sort of fires is not linear. So the way that we were taught in school was very much a linear path. I would want more concept. I would want to go like more philosophically deep with a subject and like science, like why do we need to know this? And I was right. that kid who would ask that question, and they'd say, because you need to know it. But I would say, you know, why? But why? Like I really want, I need to know why so I can then really get into it. And I just remember a specific situation where this teacher could not like acknowledge why it would be important, other than to say, well, just knowing it is what you need to worry about right now. I get that too as a teacher. Like now I'm like, no, just seriously, you just need to know. But there's also like connections and heritage. There's, you know, within my own DNA is and removed to a great grandmother. It's hard to trace back, but definitely in the Cherokee Ojibwe kind of realm. And certainly do not claim that as heritage because, you know, also being very respectful
right.
of that heritage. I know that it's part of who I am. I mean, even down, like, you know, you can see something like I look at my grandfather. I'm like, yeah, of course, you know. There's a lot of people in North Dakota that there was this, especially with Norwegians. I mean, with fur trading and all kinds of things, there was a lot of heritage that's also connected to Native American. And it's a really interesting and difficult dynamic. Knowing that's part of who I am is also explains something to me about the way that I view the world. So, yeah, non-Western in the patterns in which we think, the way that I want to, I would say I'm far more contemplative about situations. Yeah, and I'm also somewhat of a type A personality. You know, I think we all live in duality, right? That's one of the remarkable things is duality, that, you know, we aren't just one thing.
Oh, I get that one. And I've been conscious lately, very few people, in terms of the linear, are taught how to outline anymore. And it's sort of like that's all I did in school, it seemed, was to regurgitate the book in this capital letter I, you know, indent A, indent small A.
Right.
But I'm grateful for it in the way that it did help me, when I need to, be able to think in those kinds of ways.
Right.
But as you say, there's that other part of me that doesn't want to be thinking that way and wants to make sure that I'm enjoying, what was that about?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting juxtaposition, I think.
Definitely. I think it makes sense also that that kind of way of thinking ends up being really satisfied by making.
Let's talk about even just that term making a little bit, because it's interesting. When I'm not at conferences, I'm not in a world of people using that term.
Yeah.
They define themselves more by what they make. Even though when Stephen and I on this program talking with artists all the time, it is the process that is so important to them in terms of what they're really engaged in. But I think that just using that term, I know you have more thoughts about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what's happened within our, especially the academic side of the arts, is that it really becomes wrapped up into a conversation that becomes relevant only within an internal dialogue. I mean, I've lived it and experienced it. You know, I have a graduate degree in painting, so I've gone down the path of solitary artist very deeply. To just focus on the end product as the reality and the value of what you are in a culture is so limiting. If you just look at the way in which artists, artisans, craftspeople have existed throughout history, whether it's, oftentimes through history and craft, it's about indentured work, but the idea of making was always connected to a process and a social goal, typically. Now, the social goal wasn't always like the artist expressing a social goal. It was because they were part of a situation where they maybe didn't have a choice. But even artists who did were part of a social outcome as much as it was about the object or the image. But I think also the thing is that hanging on to a model that exists because of a singular viewpoint in how what we make moves into the world through a commodity kind of system is how we're teaching. And then what we do is we teach marketing classes to our students. How do we market the object? I have a lot to say about this, right? If we look at the kind of bubble of our demographics right now, we have money within baby boomers, and we have baby boomers living a long time. And it's all there. It's all data. They're moving through a stream of money that at the age of about 75, we quit acquisitioning. Like, we quit acquiring stuff. But it's like we're going to live like 15 years after the point of buying stuff, right? That's new.
Right.
So we have, in a variety of ways as fields, we've depended upon that kind of money base buying our stuff, right? If you look at who goes to conferences, who are collectors, I know we want young people to be collectors, I get that. But if we just look purely at demographics and how that, the opportunity there is for artists to understand the value of who they are and their philosophy well beyond the object into how we serve community and people, like any other profession might, right? And that's process. You talked about that is process. So what does it mean to be an artist who's living in a culture that is transitioning into a service-based economy? What does it mean? Does it mean that we continue to go down the path that if we make more interesting objects or images or stuff that people will care more? I think what's happened is that we're depending upon a kind of 1% or purchase of a lot of stuff we make. And I don't mean 1% because that's such a term, but people who can afford, which is not everybody, maybe it's 10%, right? Like, I have the ability as a kind of upper middle class, I have disposable income that I can make choices to buy artwork. But that's shrinking, right? That is disappearing in the United States. And people say, what about China? We have other markets. It's like, the reality is we're going to sell work where we live. But I think if we begin to think about what we do through the lens of how can we take the value of what we do and make it applicable in situations where people want to experience things, I think there's a huge, huge, huge opportunity.
Our guest today on Ears on Art has been Michael J. Strand. We'll continue our conversation next week when Michael will discuss this very approach. His work is based on the premise that objects, clay or otherwise, can serve as catalysts for social change. I encourage you to look him up on the web, michael.j.strand. You will find much to explore. Again, Ears on Art is produced here at KCBX Public Radio. I am Chrissy Hewitt. And on behalf of my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, who unfortunately was not at this interview in Boston, I want to thank you so much for listening and hope that you'll join us next week for part 2.